You know, my mother's going to be 80 years old in May. How cool is this? Before he left, this book I have, the Pat's book, Questions About God, he signed it over to my mother and autographed it for her. Isn't that cool? I like that. You know, of the respondents here to a 2001 survey, Ouija board users said that the board communicated malicious and frightening messages. Of all the respondents of a 2007 Harris poll, 41% said they believe in ghosts. 69% said they believed that the soul survived beyond death. In a moment, Stacey Horn joins us. Unbelievable investigations into ghosts, poltergeists, telepathy, and other unseen phenomena. And welcome back to Coast, Unbelievable. Stacey Horn, the author of Unbelievable Investigations into Ghosts, Poltergeists, Telepathy, and Other Unseen Phenomena, from the Duke Parapsychology Department. Stacey's research started with a ghost story, led to America's first parapsychology laboratory and nothing less than science's attempt to find evidence of life after death. She's a contributor to the NPR show All Things Considered, and here she is, main guest tonight on Coast to Coast. Hi, Stacey, how are you?
I'm pretty good. Thanks for having me.
Likewise. How did you get interested in this field?
Well, it originally started... I've always been interested in this field. It's very interesting, but I hadn't really researched it in any serious way. But my book before this was about the NYPD's cold case squad, and they worked to solve unsolved murders. And it was a fascinating subject to research, but I had immersed myself in this subject. And as fascinating as it is, it's also very bleak, because at the end of every story that I researched was a murder, someone who had died in a particularly horrible way, and the murder was never solved. So it was bleak and sad, and I just thought, you know, my next book, I want to just do something fun, something light. And so I had this idea, I'll write about a ghost story. What's more fun than a ghost story?
Well, I love it. I love your work here, too. And, you know, you touched on a lot of work of the late Dr. J.B. Ryan. Tell me about this this interest in him.
He's the guy that headed up the Duke Parapsychology
right.
Laboratory.
He was one of the best, too, you know?
Well, you know, I focused my study on him and the lab and their work, so... He's very important. I mean, as far as I know, he's the first parapsychologist who really applied the scientific method to this whole complex of questions. What abilities do we have? Is there anything about us that exists outside the physical body? And he standardized these procedures. He refined these experiments and the methods for analyzing the results, and came up with experiments that could be repeated in labs all over the country.
His laboratory still exists, I think, but it's not part of Duke anymore, right?
No, when he retired, they shut down the lab, but he knew that was going to happen, so he set up the lab outside of Duke, and it exists today. It's now the Ryan Research Center.
What got him interested in this field?
Well, his PhD was in botany, and so was his wife, Louisa Ryan, who everyone called Louie. And they were interested in the questions of life after death, and they always had been. But what was different about them was they were scientists, and so they wanted to see, is there a way to answer this question scientifically? Can we find evidence for life after death? And that's what brought him initially to Harvard and then to Duke.
Was this an obsession, Stacey, with trying to find these answers? Was he trying to be a debunker?
No, okay. No. He almost was, but that definitely wasn't his interest. In fact, at one point, someone asked him if they could do an article about the psychic Peter Hurkos for their Journal of Parapsychology, debunking Peter Hurkos. And Ryan turned him down. He said, you know, I'm not interested in playing that role. Even if he is, a fraud, debunking these people never stops them. and we're more interested in studying whether or not some people actually do have this ability rather than paying attention to anyone who doesn't.
He, at his time, had a lot of prominent folks go to him for answers and information, did he not?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that was one of the most fun part of my research. You know, when I got down there, I thought, oh, my God, it's going to be Ghostbusters. And I opened up the boxes, and it was like so much of it just went over my head. I don't have a background in math and science, and what I found when I opened that box was a lot of math and science. So I focused on letters where the scientists described what they were doing to other people and very often other scientists. But it was so much fun because, you know, there's 700 boxes, and I never knew, like, what was going to be in them. Like, you know, one day I'd come across a letter from Albert Einstein or Richard Nixon and basically people all over the country.
Wow. What was their interest? What did they want to find out?
Well, he kept up a correspondence with a lot of people, and what usually it was like something strange happened to them, not with Albert Einstein. Albert Einstein, I think Rhine wrote him first, and they didn't talk a lot, and Einstein was very polite, but at first not terribly open to this subject. He didn't put Rhine off, but he's just like, I don't know what to make of it, basically. But he softened over time and changed his position. I wouldn't call him accepting of the results, but he said they started to intrigue him, and he said one shouldn't go through the world, you know, with blinders on. We should have an open mind.
Stacey, are there any universities at all doing what J.B. Rhine was doing at Duke today?
Well, the closest one to it closed in 2001, and that was at Princeton, and it was a lab called the Pear Lab.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was writing my book and I heard about that lab, I was, like, very excited to meet Robert John and Brenda Dunn, who run this lab, just because I was just so curious to see what their experience was. I mean, one of the things that surprised me when I wrote this book and started reading these letters through from all these scientists was how hostile the scientists were. I mean, I had a very, because I don't have a background in science, I had a very naive idea of what scientists were like. I mean, it's going to sound stupid, but I just thought that they were more objective and more rational than me. And it turns out, of course, they're human, and their letters to Rhine were just so emotional, snarky, smug. I mean, I just was really shocked. And I always heard that part of their problem with Rhine was, you know, he wasn't a real scientist. His PhD was in botany. And if he was a real scientist, meaning if he was a physicist, we would have accepted his results.
Right, or a psychiatrist or something, right?
So Robert John, the guy that headed up the Pear Lab, he was a physicist, and he was the former dean of Princeton School of Engineering and Applied Science. So he's a real scientist. So theoretically, they should have accepted his results. But I talked to him. He's a very nice man, and his experience was exactly the same as Rhine, just paralleled exactly.
Stacey, tell me about some of the experiments that they conducted at Duke University under Rhine's tutelage. What did they try to do?
Well, initially their mission was to see if they could find evidence of life after death. So they started with mediums, and they had this guy, John Thomas, this public school administrator, who brought them to Duke. And he had 800 pages of results from mediums that he had consulted trying to communicate with his dead wife. So they went through all this trouble of verifying the medium's results. And again and again and again and again, the mediums were able to come up with information where just realistically they had no way of knowing these facts. But it occurred to Rhine, you know, John Thomas thought, well, they're getting the information from my dead wife. But the Rhine thought, yeah, but there could be another explanation, and that's telepathy, getting information from someone else's mind, like John Thomas, you know, himself,
right,
from the mind of the living. So they decided, well, The best first step to answer the question of whether or not there's life after death is to find if there's something about us that can operate independently of the body. I mean, we know the body dies. There's just no dispute about that. So here's this thing, telepathy. If we can establish that telepathy is real, then it's something that operates outside of us. So when the body goes, it just opens the door to the possibility of something of us continuing. So they came up with this experiment. These ESP cards, a lot of people have seen them. They're the ones, these five cards with, a star, a cross, wavy lines. And it's just a very simple, unambiguous experiment. They would have these cards and they would see if people could know what was on these cards without seeing them. And they refined the experiment over the years. So eventually they were doing it completely double blind, like, the person mm-hmm. trying to guess the cards was not anywhere near the cards, and the people testing them did not know what symbols were on the cards. And they found that people could say what was on these cards more than what could be expected by chance.
Tell me more about the experience with Marjorie. What do we have here?
Well, Marjorie, they first went to Harvard, and Marjorie was a very famous medium at the time, and so they decided they would investigate her, and that's pretty much where they began, and that set the stage for them, what their experience is. She was this very beautiful woman. Another medium that they studied called her the loveliest, most captivating woman I've ever met.
Hmm.
And she was married to a very respectable doctor. They were living in Boston. And they put on these, I don't even know how to describe them, psychic performances in their home for people. And she was frequently naked in these performances.
What?
I have a picture of it. And that was.
I guess that took everybody's mind off the fact that maybe she wasn't a good medium or psychic, huh?
It just made her more popular.
How bizarre.
In those days, there was a lot of sexual undertones to mediums. This was not unusual. But she was naked because sometimes during these displays, ectoplasm would come out from between her legs. So that was so people could see the ectoplasm. It was very lurid and very hokey. And the rhymes were, so serious. So I could just picture them, walking into the room, with pencils and clipboards, thinking they're going to study this person and seeing this.
Didn't Harry Houdini go after her or something like that?
Yeah.
To try to destroy her? I don't know. What was that story?
Well, I don't know if he wanted to destroy her, but definitely to debunk her and it became a myth. Well, it was one of his missions in life was to debunk people like that, and she was one of the people that he did. But the Rhines wrote up a very scathing review of what they found, and it was published in an academic journal, but it was also picked up by all these newspapers around the country. So this unknown couple all of a sudden became famous, and people like Arthur Conan Doyle were publicly condemning him in newspapers. It was a rocky start, but that's what got them to do.
Interesting. Okay, now what did the lab, in its years of existence, conducting ESP experiments for years, what did they finally conclude before they shut down?
Well, they came up with evidence of ESP. Their experiments were in telepathy, psychokinesis, that's ability to move objects with your mind. Yeah, I imagine your listeners are all very familiar with these.
They're good. They're going to enjoy this night.
precognition, seeing the future, and clairvoyance, getting information from other sources other than other people's minds. And over and over and over again, they were able to come up with evidence that these abilities exist.
Beyond a shadow of a doubt, that was their conclusion. This is real.
Yes. Now, they were scientists, so they were always open to other explanations for these abilities. I mean, they had their theories. And that was actually part of the problem was, even though they were able to come up with evidence for these abilities repeatedly, that's all they did. They were never able to learn how it operates, and as a result, they were never able to enhance it or control it, which I mean, probably these results never would have been accepted, but if they could have done just anything to explain them or enhance them, that certainly would have helped.
I think for this field, it's unfortunate that the Duke is not continuing on. You know, surely they could have found somebody after Dr. Ryan decided to retire, right?
Well, initially they were open to that idea, and they had this plan, and I saw it, and I actually loved their plan. They wanted to make it a much more multidisciplinary center, so there would be representatives from almost every department at Duke, like, you know, people from the various other sciences and people from the School of Religion and History. And I really liked that idea. But when they started talking to other professors around Duke, they were very resistant. And Ryan started to get the idea that if this new lab existed, parapsychology would just be subsumed by it. And he was probably right. And that's why he decided, instead of like throwing in his lot with this new vision of it, he started the lab outside Duke after he retired.
Tell us about your research, Stacy. How did you go at this in the beginning?
Well, again, like, it was all over my head, so I focused on the letters, the book is about the Rhine lab, but I also every once in a while went outside the lab to show a picture of what parapsychology was like around the country and in other people's minds. Like, here are the Rhines going along, you know, trying to make it more scientific, and there's still people, you know, with Ouija boards and seances at the same time. And I would just go on these very interesting side trips, and one of my favorites was I'm going through these letters, and this letter came in 1960 from this father, Joseph Kremen, in California, and he wrote because his 6-year-old boy had gone missing, and he was writing the Rhines asking for help. I think a lot of people just had this idea that the parapsychology lab was basically a stable of psychics.
Sure, and remote viewers, which they probably weren't aware of the name then at the time.
Yeah, and Ryan did not like to give out the names of psychics. It's not that he didn't, you know, believe that psychics had these abilities, but it was more like they just couldn't verify the information that the psychics came, even when it was actually correct.
He didn't want to endorse them, I guess, Stacy, right?
Yeah. So, but this guy was, you know, kept writing, and he was very upset, and Ryan was a father himself, and he just didn't want to take away what this guy felt was his only hope. So he gave them the name of 3 psychics, but he basically said, you know, do not give them a lot of money, you know, their expenses to get there and help you, fine, but just don't give them a lot of money. So he's basically, you know, just trying to make sure the guy doesn't get ripped off.
Right, absolutely. Let's talk a little bit more about this case and some of the other letters. Plus, with Duke University, though they focused a lot on ESP, they also wanted to investigate poltergeists. We'll talk about that in a moment with our special guest, Stacy Horn. Her work is called Unbelievable. Okay, on Tuesday, for you StreamLink members, at 8 p.m. Pacific time, we're going to do our monthly chat. So come on in. The room fills up awfully fast. If I'm about 2 or 3 minutes late, just hang in there. I'll be there. I've got a meeting at 6 o'clock, and I'm going to try to wrap that up as soon as I can. But we will be chatting at 8 p.m. Pacific time on Tuesday night. Stacy, back to Marjorie for just a moment. Why was Harry Houdini successful in kind of chastising her? Did she not have the abilities that she claimed she did?
You know, I always wonder about that. I don't know, because I only researched Marjorie and how her life intersected with J.B. Ryan, so I didn't really research the Houdini part of the story.
Okay.
But I tend to think, you know, I researched a bunch of psychics, and A lot of them seem to have some ability, but they couldn't control it. And instead of just being like, "I'm sorry, this is the best I can do," you know, it's not in my control. They tried to exaggerate and augment, and when they couldn't come up with images, and that could be the case with her. I had some sympathy towards her. Her story was more sad to me than angering, because sometimes she embellished. She was basically this like scared, uneducated farm girl, and she was married to this guy who had been married, I think, twice before. Mm-hmm. And I think she was just afraid of losing her husband, and he was into this, and maybe she had some abilities, and so, okay. And
she just wanted to keep him happy, right?
And it just spiraled. I don't think she was a bad person.
Tell me more about this letter about this missing boy, Bruce Kremen.
Yeah, that was heartbreaking. So Ron gave him the names of three psychics.
To the father.
Yeah. And the father consulted, he contacted all three, but basically focused on these two, Peter Hurkos and Harold Sherman. Harold Sherman just told him pretty bluntly, but tried to be as kind about as he could, that his son had been murdered.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Ugh.
It was, and the letter that Sherman wrote to Ryan about it, it was like, oh, God, you know, how do you tell someone this? And he tried to, like, you know, even if your son is dead, even if my visions are correct, and they may not be, you know, because he was honest. He said, I don't always know which are correct and which aren't. But if they are, I believe, you know, there is life after death, so he exists somewhere.
Yep,
he's not
gone.
But this other guy, Peter Hurkos, gave a completely different picture. He said, your son was picked up by this childless couple who wanted a child, and now they're taking care of him in a farm in Oregon. And it was a beautiful picture. So you can imagine who the family decided to believe.
They needed to.
Yeah.
So what happened?
So Hurkos, who was living in Miami, came to Los Angeles, and he basically just made a bad situation even worse. He just dragged it out. And
was he getting paid for this?
By
the hour, right?
I don't know how much he was getting paid. He definitely was getting paid, because it's mentioned in the letters, but not the amount. So Kremen wrote Ryan months later saying, you know, the guy gave us information, said he would give us more, said he would come back. He's disappeared and help. And I talk about this letter in the book. And so Ryan writes this letter back to Kremen, saying, you know, please be patient. People who have these abilities, you know, even when they do, they can't control when the images come, so please be patient. But the whole letter, even though it's to Kremen, he CCs Hurkos, and it's basically, don't you dare continue to drag this out. You know, if you can't help them, you know, come clean and end this. It's a beautiful letter of compassion. I just got into this chapter, I guess, because I got to use whatever amateur detective skills I have, and I just started researching Peter Hurkos and all some of the more famous cases that he claimed to have helped.
Now, with the little missing boy, did they ever conclude what happened to him?
Thank you for, you know, I get sidetracked, but
that's what I'm here for.
But that was, like, I have these blogs where I basically talk about my life, you know, for anyone who wants to hear. So as I was researching the Kremen story, I was talking on the blog about how it was going. So I wrote the chapter, and thinking I was done, what I thought was going to be the last thing, I called up the missing persons department in Los Angeles just to find out where the case ended up. And what I expected here, because of what I've learned about cold cases, was they'd get on the phone and say, yeah, we haven't done anything since 1961. You know, but once they exhaust all their leads, you know, unless they have new evidence,
it's
that's
done.
That.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I expected them to tell me that.
Almost like the Chandra Levy case, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, all of a sudden more information pops up years later and they get back into it.
You never know.
You never
know. So I call missing persons, and so they say, yeah, oh, great, okay. So they go to pull the file, and the woman comes back on the phone, and she says, we don't have it. The cold case squad has it. And I got all excited because I thought, I knew there is just no way a cold case squad detective is going to drive over and pick up a file unless they have
something
new
else. Yeah.
So, which made me happy. I had talked to Bruce Kremen's mother. She's still alive, and it was one of the worst phone calls of my life. She just started crying. Oh. I mean, yeah, for her, it was like it had happened yesterday. Yeah, it was awful. So I call the cold case squad detective, and she says, yes, I have the case, and I'd be happy to talk to you, but, you know, I just can't talk to you for, like, another month. And I said, fine. And I posted about this on my blog, and soon after, I get email from another writer named Weston DeWalt, who had been researching another missing boy who went missing roughly the same time in the same area. And he became obsessed, and he uncovered new evidence. And so now the cold case squad and other law enforcement agencies in California have picked up and gathered all these cases and are investigating them. He found evidence to tie Bruce Kremen and the boy that he was researching to this child serial killer, Mac Ray Edwards. Who was killing children, I think, for like 3 decades. The story broke, and it was in all the newspapers. They even did a dig not too long ago in California, not for Bruce Kremen, but for another boy. But now it's like it's an active case again.
So we're assuming the little boy was killed.
Yes.
Obviously.
Yes, and I talked to the cold case detective, and she's fairly confident that Mac Ray Edwards killed Bruce Kremen. Oh, and that's like the best part. So I had these descriptions that Peter Hercos and Harold Sherman had given of who they, like, for Harold Sherman it was a murderer, and for the Hercos it was this couple, this Oregon couple. So I asked the cold case detective to tell me, and Weston DeWalt, to tell me if there was anything in these descriptions that matched what they believed to be true. And they both said, you know, Peter Hercos, nothing, but Harold Sherman, yes, there was actually a lot. But they didn't go into a lot of detail. And then when the story broke, I read a witness description of the last person to be seen with Bruce Kremen, who may have been Mac Ray Edwards. And it fit Harold Sherman's description exactly. I mean, really, really exactly.
What happened to Sherman now? Is he dead?
Yeah, yeah. And so is Mac Ray Edwards. He killed himself in prison.
How many people did they, or children, did they think he killed?
Well, he confessed to 18. He was convicted for 3. And he killed himself before they could really investigate and corroborate the others.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Ghosts. Poltergeists. They investigated that as well, did they not?
Yeah. They investigated both. I'm trying to think of which to talk about first, because there's like 2 separate investigations. I think I'll talk about the poltergeist case, just because that's kind of fun.
Why don't you talk about the poltergeist case?
Well, when I started this book, my own position on these various subjects, I mean, even though I found them fascinating, I was pretty agnostic and even more towards skeptic on some of them, and poltergeist would definitely be one that I was skeptical about. And I researched this one case that they investigated. It was a really good case. It was it took place on Long Island in 1958, and they were always interested in studying poltergeist because for them, they had their theory was that it wasn't a noisy spirit, but someone in the vicinity with very dramatic psychokinetic abilities. And so they wanted to see if they could verify their theory. But the problem was most poltergeist cases are very short-lived, and so they were over by the time they heard about them. But then they got started getting letters and calls about this case out in Seaford, Long Island. So Gaither Pratt, one of their senior scientists, dropped everything, got on a plane, went to Seaford, and he opens the door, he walks in, and things just immediately started happening. Something crashed and fell in the basement. They all run into the basement, and when they're in the basement, things started falling upstairs when there was nobody there. So it was, like, very exciting. It was, like, a real active case.
Yeah.
And that was fun to research, too, because, again, I got to, like, play amateur detective, and because of my cold case connections, I contacted the Nassau County Police, and they hunted around, and they found the original police case files for this case. Oh, yeah, because I forgot to mention, like, a lot of the times when things like this happen, people, they either call the priest or the cops. And in this case, they called the cops, and it was assigned to a detective who actually just gave it his all trying to solve the case, like figure out what was happening. And so I read through his case reports, and it was just hysterical because he's like this very serious, straight arrow cop, and so he's writing everything in cop language, but he's describing, you know, utterly fantastic things, like, you know, centerpiece moved, you know, 8 inches in the southwesterly direction on the coffee table and fell 2 feet to the floor, you know. Shampoo moves in easterly direction on bathroom. I mean, it's hysterical. And he consulted everything, you know, everyone he could think of. And he unfortunately has since died, but I found his daughter and I asked her, you know, what did he think? And she said, you know, my dad was just like how you imagine he was. Like, he didn't believe any of this, and he was like kind of annoyed that he got this case, but he gave it his all. And she said there was one time when he was at the house investigating, and he was with the boy, there were two children in the house, and something hit the back of his legs. It turned out to be this small statue of a horse, but there was nobody behind him to throw this horse. And he just, like, he had integrity, and he had to say, you know, I researched it, and I have concluded that it's not a hoax. I cannot explain it, but it's not a hoax. And Gaither Pratt reached a similar conclusion. He wrote this 45-page paper and, you know, completely analyzed and researched 67 events in the house and concluded that 17 of them, there was just no explanation for them, any normal explanation for them, and also concluded that the case was not a hoax.
Of the work that they did, how many staff members do you know that JB had, Brian?
Well, it varied over the years. Like, they might, the staff might be relatively small, like 4 or 5 scientists, but it was Duke University, so they also always had a lot of graduate students in the lab assisting them.
As you were going through the boxes of letters, you also came across one, I'm told, by the priest who was in the original Exorcist.
Oh, yeah. And when I came across that letter, I didn't know that The Exorcist was based on a real kid. I had even read the book, and I saw the movie, and I just thought it was all fiction. So I'm going through the letters, and I come across this letter from a priest, and I'm reading it, and I'm going, Jesus, this sounds exactly like The Exorcist. I mean, he's talking about a little boy, not a girl, but a little boy, and his bed moves, and words appear on his skin. I mean, it's just like the movie. And so I Google, because I've got the name of the kid from the letter, and I Google it, and sure enough, you know, I learned that The Exorcist was based on a real kid, and this
sure
was the kid. And to me, this is one of the more convincing letters I came across, because this particular priest didn't think it was possession. He was writing rhyme because he didn't know what it was. He was leaning towards, you know, a poltergeist.
Really? Okay.
Well, he didn't think it was possession. There was nothing about it that seemed demonic to him. And Ryan asked him to describe something that he had witnessed personally. And so he described this event that happened in his house one night. The boy was staying with him because they thought it would give him a break from all the stuff that was happening. So he was at the priest's house, and the priest said, He woke up and the kid was awake, and the kid was upset because the bed was shaking in this house just like it had been in his home. And he had gotten off the bed and he was sitting in a chair, and he had his feet up on the chair. And the priest said, while I watched, the chair with the boy in it just slowly slid back until it hit the wall and then toppled over. And Ryan was like, you didn't, like, make any attempt to, like, help the kid. You just stood there and watched. And the priest is, like, trying to explain, like, why he was, like, paralyzed and didn't do anything. And he was just kind of honest. And he said, that I just had to. I just had to watch and see if it would continue.
Do you remember the priest's name?
Oh, my God. You know,
was that Bishop?
No.
Father Raymond Bishop? St. Louis University.
Excuse me?
Was he St. Louis University?
No. They did go to St. Louis, and that's where the exorcism actually took place.
Right.
You're right. No, this was, his name was Schultz. I don't know why I'm blanking. I'm quick looking.
All right, because there are a couple priests that were involved in that.
Luther Schultz. This guy did not participate in the exorcism. This was their original family priest that they went to.
Bowdern, Father Bowdern, was the one who did the original exorcism of the little boy.
And then
they refused to talk to the media, by the way, just died.
Yeah, one of them did. One of the guys, he wasn't the lead exorcist. He was basically
He was the young one that we saw in the movie.
Yes, exactly. Who was assisted?
Exactly.
And he didn't think it was possession either.
Well, but did they think at all that there was a mental condition here?
I think that there was to a certain extent, but there, like for instance, what Schultz described with the chair, something else was going on too, and so that's why Schultz was leaning towards the poltergeist. It was like the only thing left that he could explain it with, but he kept trying to get the family to take the boy to see doctors, and they did, but the doctors couldn't explain it and couldn't help, and that's why they went to the Catholic priest for the exorcist, because they at least offered the potential for relief.
See, I'm told that the hospital where they performed the exorcism in that room, that later on they auctioned off, like the chest that was in the room and the bed and stuff like that. And the people who bought them also had very bizarre demonic things happening. Now, that's what I've always been told, and I come from St. Louis.
I've never heard that part of the story.
That is a weird one.
But I did hear that the room was closed for many years, and then when it was opened again, they found the priest's diary.
And, of course, the hospital has since been closed.
No.
I don't think it's open. Election Brothers Hospital?
Oh, yeah, it's still open, but
that
building doesn't exist anymore.
Well, that's what I mean.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that section of that hospital is gone.
Yes.
All gone.
Yes.
All right, well, stay with us. More to come. We'll talk about more things that were going on at the J.B. Ryan Institute at Duke University, the Division of Parapsychology Laboratory, when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM.